Every day I'm hustling. 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 Every day I'm hustling.
Hey guys, welcome back to Jules on the Hustle. I hope everyone is doing well. Things have been super hectic on my end, working my full-time job at NBC Sports. And now I'd like to announce to you all, I am also training for the New York City Marathon. So working two full-time jobs, which is a great time. And if you didn't know, now you'll know that I am not a long-distance runner by any means. So this is an extra struggle for me. And I'm doing my 32-week marathon training plan because it's more slower, and gradual, rather than doing just like a 16-week hardcore training plan. So we're doing that, and we are running for the Colon Cancer Foundation, a cause and a disease that's near and dear to me and my family. So if you'd like to donate, I'd really appreciate it. I'm currently at $2,500 and I need to make it to $3,500. So every little bit helps. I have a link on my Twitter and Instagram, or you can just DM me and I will send you the link. Any donation is very much appreciated and welcomed for this such great cause. Anyway, this week I had the honor and privilege of having International Tennis Hall of Famer Tracy Austin on my podcast. She is an incredible reporter and former tennis player. She was the youngest tennis player to win the U.S. Open and still remains to be the youngest. And she was also the youngest person to be inducted into the Hall of Fame, which is located in Newport, Rhode Island. So it's great to have Tracy. I hope you guys enjoyed the episode.
All right. So Tracy, how did it feel then, and how does it feel now to be the youngest tennis player to be inducted into the Hall of Fame?
That's a really interesting question, because I was 29 when I went into the Hall. So I'll be honest with you, it was 99% over the top happiness, 1% feeling like, oh, I could have played a longer career, because I retired young because of injuries. The Hall of Fame is the ultimate in our sport. To receive that honor is something that you're so proud of. It's voted on, so you really feel like you've earned the highest honor. And at the end of your career, it's kind of the culmination, and it's a nice way to finish it.
So does it feel better, you think, then or now, that recognition, or about both, like feeling amazing?
I'd say they're even, whether it's then or whether it's now. The Hall of Fame in Newport, Rhode Island is such a beautiful place, such a historic place. It feels a little bit like Wimbledon when you walk into those ivy-covered walls with the grass courts at Wimbledon. The Hall of Fame obviously played on grass today as well. So you feel like some of the top players of every era going way back played there. So it's nice to go back into the museum. They've done a terrific job to bring out different pieces that are important in history, different storylines that are kind of iconic in tennis. And now what they're doing is they're engaging in iconic moments of tennis history vote, which is very exciting to try to get everybody back into the conversation about so many storylines that have sparked our interest over the years.
Well, let's go into those different categories and iconic moments. So the five I have in front of me are most epic rivalry, best Cinderella story, of course. The one I think of most recently was at the 2021 US Open with Raducanu. Best comeback within a match, most iconic celebration, best moment of national pride. Of course, think of Barty most recently. I wish I watched more tennis back in the 90s, but I was a little young. But let's start with most epic rivalry. I know you got some of these in front of you here. Any of these just like stand out as moments? You're like, wow, this will stick with me forever.
Absolutely. And as you said, I think this is a great opportunity for some people at my age that remember all of these rivalries to reminisce. But for people that are younger like you, it's a chance to really learn about these rivalries that were so fantastic. I think back to Bjorn Borg, McEnroe, and Connors. That was such an interesting rivalry between the three of them. Jimmy Connors was actually older than Bjorn by about 4 years, older than McEnroe by about 7 years. Bjorn was ice. You know, you never got any emotion from him. He was so consistent. And then you had Jimmy Connors, who was fire. And he was fist pumping and getting the crowd involved. A few years later comes a young American from Queens, New York, who's even more brash and more opinionated, and this incredible lefty serve and volleyer in John McEnroe. That was an incredible rivalry between Jimmy Connors and John McEnroe. It was very apparent there was no love lost. And that's what made it so much fun to watch those matches, because, you know, sports, we want to bring up emotions, whether we want this person to win or that person to lose. And now you have this somewhat of a boxing match between Connors and McEnroe. I think that was really amazing rivalry that between those three guys. Another one is the one that's possibly starting to come to an end in the next couple of years, with Roger Federer being 40 years old, Novak Djokovic, and Rafael Nadal. To think about what those guys have done for the last couple of decades, where they stayed at the top of the game, they were always in the conversation to win a major, and continued throughout those couple of decades to stay motivated, injury-free, long enough to push for winning majors. And each winning at least 20. That's insane, until Rafa won the Australian Open this year after being down two sets to love. That's in part of a comeback within a match category. I that's one of my favorite of all time, with everything that was on the line, the history there. So it really brings up the point that there were so few players that got to win majors, because those guys pretty much hoarded them all.
Hey Hustlers, I just got back from Denver and it was such a great time, but there was one thing that made it extra special, and it was staying at the Catbird Hotel. So the Catbird Hotel is in Denver's Reno neighborhood, and it's just such a homey but hip place. It has that beautiful balance of, you know, when you walk in, it's so modern, but like really cozy with the fireplace and the couches. I mean, the lobby was arguably one of my favorite parts. It's such a great start to the hotel. Then when you walk into your room, and on your way to the room, there's artwork everywhere. And it's so unique and beautiful, and it just gives the hotel this just vibrant feel, like lots of great energy, and we love that. In the rooms, we got yoga mats and weights, so promoting a healthy lifestyle. I totally appreciate that. The bed was elevated, so there was storage underneath. The way they utilized space in the room was so smart, and I'm totally considering that for my New York City apartment, actually. The TV projector was phenomenal. Loved my TV. It made my experience incredible. And the view to the city was breathtaking. The Denver lights, I miss that so much. Next, we have the rooftop overlooking the city with the Red Barber restaurant, which also had a bar. The food was delicious and the drinks were bomb. Also, the happy hour had some incredible deals. I went there as much as I could. Lastly, you can have great meetings there, weddings, or any event you can think of the Catbird Hotel can host. So I truly had the best time ever. And if you want to book your stay or event, head over to catbirdhotel.com. You won't regret it.
I think the rivalry that I enjoyed the most was with Chris Evert, because she was somebody that looked up to as a child. I was a ball girl for her, for the Virginia Slims of Los Angeles. I liked the way that she was on the court. She was so elegant. She seemed fair. So eventually when I got to play against her and then beat her in the finals of the US Open, we played a number of times. I felt like I was playing a mirror image when I played against Chrissy. We were both steady from the baseline, trying to outmaneuver each other. And I ended up actually having a winning record against her when I retired.
Very, very, very nice. All right, let's go into best Cinderella story. We got a lot of great ones here. Any that stand out to you?
Well, the one that's, I don't think is ever going to be repeated. It's hard to say never, but it happened last summer with Emma Raducanu. At the beginning of the summer at Wimbledon, Emma from Great Britain got to the fourth round at Wimbledon. And before Wimbledon, most of us had never heard of her besides the people that were in England and followed her as a junior. So the fact that from the fourth round at Wimbledon was a huge breakout to 2 months later, winning the US Open as a qualifier, winning 10 matches in a row without losing a set, ranked around 150 in the world, is something that you would think maybe was from a movie and was not going to be believable. The other one I love is, is Goran Ivanišević, who was, I believe, 29 years old, from Croatia, huge lefty serve. So a serve and volleyer at Wimbledon. He had lost in three finals prior to getting a wild card the year that he eventually won it. I think most everybody in tennis thought Goran's time had passed. And let's give this guy who had had great finals three times here. He's now ranked 125 in the world, outside the top 100. Probably will lose early, but he's most likely going to retire soon. So let's give him one last chance, a wild card. And he goes through and wins the title, beats Tim Henman, who's also from Great Britain. They might have thought twice about that wild card if they knew he was going to beat Tim Henman. Right. And then wins in the finals over Patrick Rafter on a Monday. And they called it People's Monday, because instead of everybody having those tickets that they knew they had for a month, it was kind of wide open. And it was just a different atmosphere, because a lot of the people that had tickets had to go to work on that Monday. So for Goran to win and then go back to Croatia, where there were tens of thousands in a celebration, in a parade, in a soccer stadium, it was something that was to be remembered.
Amazing. Wow. Let's go into best comeback within a match.
Best comeback within a match. I am going to talk about something that we all recently saw because of the historical implications. Rafa Nadal, last year, 2021, played Washington, D.C. Foot was still bothering him, so he took the rest of the year off. Comes into the Australian Open. He just recently had gotten over COVID about 2 or 3 weeks before. So you're thinking, not really prepared because of the COVID diagnosis a couple of weeks ago. Gets to the finals at the Australian. He's got 20 majors. Roger Federer has 20 majors. Novak Djokovic has 20 majors, and Novak Djokovic, if you remember, was not allowed to play. He was sent home after already being there. So there was so much drama surrounding this Australian Open. Rafa Nadal, 35 years old, gets to the finals, plays this new upstart, Daniil Medvedev from Russia. Daniil is up two sets to love. Rafa serving 2-3, 15-40. Loses that point. He's down a break in the third, and most likely he will lose the match and he'll still be at 20. He somehow gets his way out of that big hole, down two sets to love, and comes back and wins in five sets after having that injury last year, COVID, you know, everything tied at 20. I don't remember seeing, Rafa's full of joy, but he seemed the most joyful that I'd ever seen him when he won at number 21 at the Australian Open final. It was something that brought tears to everybody that was watching.
That was epic. Definitely, most definitely epic. This one was challenging for me, this next category, because I don't know too many of these, to be honest, although my dad said that the Jimmy Connors fist pump was amazing. But most iconic celebration, Tracy.
Yeah, you know what I love about this for you, Julia, is that you say you don't remember many of the eight of these. And I think that it's kind of fun for you to go back and look at these, or maybe bring them up on YouTube for a minute or two. Quickly, Pat Cash was the first champion after winning a major to go up into the stands and hug his entourage. So now that's kind of become the norm, where they actually put ladders up or stairs up. That's right. Something that he started. And Kim Clijsters with her daughter, everybody that watched that, coming back after being a mother and winning the US Open. Guga Kuerten, who put a heart on the court. He was so beloved at the French Open. He was this kind of surfer dude, slinky ground strokes, and you just kind of wanted to root for him. The fist pump of Jimmy Connors, he was 38 or 39 years old in 1991 US Open, getting to the semifinals. I know I'm talking about all of these, but Jim Courier diving into the Yara after he wins the Australian Open, the Peter Korda scissor kick, which now has gone on to his kids. Novak Djokovic and a Serbian teammate shaving their head. That's commitment is what I'm going to call that. And this is the one that, because you played on the pro tour, this is the one I want you to go back and explore a little bit more.
Okay.
It's King's racket toss after winning the Battle of the Sexes. I remember exactly where I was. I was at the Jack Kramer Tennis Club inside the pro shop. They had a TV, and I was probably 10 years old when Billie Jean King was going to play Bobby Riggs, who was 55 years old. He said he was a male chauvinist. He kind of put down women's tennis. I don't know whether he really believed that, or was that for, you know, stoking the media. And they were going to play 3 out of 5 sets. This put tennis on the map in a big way, because there were 30,000 people watching live in the Houston Astrodome, but 90 million people watching worldwide. And it was Billie Jean King playing for equality and equal rights and equal prize money. This obviously passed tennis and got into just people watching and being interested in what was happening. So that's the one. Actually, I don't want to say that's what I would vote for, because I don't want to influence anyone, but that's,
no, definitely.
That's a pretty important one.
That's an important one. Well, you kind of reflected on a few of these. So it's interesting how some of these have turned into like regular traditions now, like going into the stands. That's like, if you don't do that, that's strange, I guess you could say.
We're looking for that, because that's the moment in sports when you look, when there's so much tension for 2 hours or 3 hours, and then finally the moment comes when their dream becomes reality, and you want to see how that person reacts and then shares it with people that who have been with them for either a year or 10 years or their family forever. That's the kind of emotions that we want drawn up, and that only sports can bring up.
Most definitely. One that's not on here is Djokovic eating grass at Wimbledon, but that's okay.
You're right. I mean, there's so many.
There are so many.
And you know what's really important is that the Tennis Hall of Fame, who has done a great job, by the way, it was Hall of Famer Steve Flink, and it was Joel Drucker, historian at large, and Nina Pantic, who kind of put this list together. And it's over 7 decades. It's about men's and women's tennis, and it's across the globe. You know, we have people from Brazil, we have people from Serbia. And I think it gives people a chance when they vote to get into a lively debate about tennis and about these storylines that spark their love for our sport. It's a very smart thing and a fun thing that the International Tennis Hall of Fame is doing.
I completely agree. It gives, you know, people and maybe that were born more recently to like look back and see how the game has evolved and what people did back then and stuff like that. Best moment of national pride.
Best moment of national pride. Okay. Well, there's so many. It's hard to beat Ash Barty winning the Australian Open in January of this year and then retiring. Apparently, she really was already spent before. She kind of won Wimbledon last year, and that was her moment where she really felt like she had accomplished everything that she wanted to. Yeah. So the off season, the preseason coming into 2022, her coach said it was really tough to push her. I think Ash did it for the entire country of Australia. She wanted to win it for them. Yeah. So for her to be able to hold her nerve, know that she probably was going to retire soon and win the Australian Open, the last person to win an Australian that was a native was 1978, so more than 40 years. It was a great moment, but there's so many, whether it's Andy Murray winning Wimbledon, it'd been 77 years since Fred Perry had won, Virginia Wade winning in 77 at Wimbledon when the Queen was actually there. It was a silver jubilee year. Lee Knopf,
Roland. I love that one.
You probably love that one because you remember that one.
Oh yeah, there seems to be a trend between me picking ones that I saw.
That you saw, which is understandable. But Lena in Roland Garros, she really excited and sparked an interest in tennis for the biggest country, you know, population-wise, probably in our world. And then there's so many others. Althea Gibson winning Wimbledon was very, very exciting, and coming back to a ticker tape parade in New York City. So very tough to vote. I don't know. What would you pick?
I mean, as you said, my picks aren't great because I haven't, you know, I have to do more research on all of these, but for me, it's Barty and Lee Na. I mean, Andy Murray was amazing as well, but I don't.
The pressure on him that he was feeling to play at Wimbledon with all the hopes of the crowd of Wimbledon and that nation, you know, on his back. That's the thing, is I feel like as an American, oftentimes we haven't had as much pressure because we've spread out that pressure because we've had so many champions.
Yeah.
But the likes of an Andy Murray or an Ash Barty or a Virginia Wade or a Lee Na, it's like they are it. They are the one. Amélie Mauresmo in France. And so there's more pressure.
Most definitely. So going off of these amazing moments, let's talk a little bit about American tennis and where American tennis is headed. Unfortunately, there's only 4 American women in the top 25. I mean, not like unfortunately, because it's the most of any other nation, I guess, in the top 25. We got Collins, Pegula, Goff, and Keys. And on the men's side, we have Fritz, Opelka, Isner. Where do you see the future of men's and women's tennis going?
I'm feeling good about the men's tennis, better than I felt in years, because I think there are a number of names that I can say they might be able to win a major in the future. We got Taylor Fritz
on fire
at a rapid rate. His game has always been there, but he's starting to trust himself more, and he's starting to believe that he can take down the big names on a consistent basis. You got Riley Opelka, 7 feet tall. You can't teach 7 feet with that big serve. And he's consistently starting to go to finals or win titles now. I would not want to play Riley on grass with that big serve. And he just takes huge cuts at the return as well. Sebastian Korda has an all-court game. He's very calm. I think he has an opportunity possibly to win in the future. Jensen Brooksby. So I think we're starting to find there's a foundation, and there's some players that can do well and maybe win a major, because Andy Roddick was the last on the men's side in 2003 to do that. On the women's side, we've been spoiled with Venus and Serena. Venus winning 7 majors and Serena winning 23. We got Sloane Stephens, who won the US Open that once. I still think Sloane has one more push in her before she retires, because she has so much talent, the offense, the defense. It's just a question of motivation for her. Madison Keys could beat anybody on a given day. The problem is her fluctuations are pretty wide and pretty extreme. Anna Samova, we didn't mention her. She's ranked just outside the top 30. Top
20. Right outside. That's right. Yeah.
And I think that she is 20 years old. She's been to the semifinals of the French. I still think she has big capabilities. And then Coco Gauff is 18. Everything's starting to gel. The forehand is starting to shore up. It was very brittle. In the last couple of years, you could hit to that side and you weren't sure whether Coco was going to spray it or not. Her second serve is more reliable. And I think because Coco has been around for so long, we think that she's older than 18. So I'm hopeful. I just think, Julia, we've been really spoiled in the United States with a long line of champions on both the men and the women's side. With tennis being so much more international and still just the top 100 really kind of involved in the conversation at majors, and the top 10 most likely going to win majors. It's just spread out more, and it's tougher for the Americans to get in that conversation.
I mean, we almost had Danielle winning the Australian Open, but Ashley Barty was just too good and made her country super proud. But I don't think I definitely think Danielle has it in her to win a slam. She's so fierce
and feisty. Yes.
So feisty. And I'm honestly, like, besides Barty being an absolutely incredible tennis player, I'm surprised her personality, because she's so, like, nice and kind to everyone. I'm surprised her personality did so well on tour.
You know what she was able to do, which is very rare, is she was able to separate tennis and who she was off the court. So often, and you could speak to this, is our results kind of get tied up in who we are.
Yeah. And
Ash Barty seemed to be a tennis player, but was able to separate all of that. Did that magnificently. So the tributes to her when she retired from other players, some of them even said, I never liked losing, but if I had to lose to someone, I'd rather lose to Ash Barty. That's a high compliment. Yeah. He was going to miss her. We're going to miss her style of play because it was so different, the slice, the drop shot, the volleys, her athleticism. But I think mostly we're going to miss her character. It just really feels like she played with fairness. She played with the right perspective. She enjoyed her time. And for her to be able to walk away from the game when she felt like she was spent, as she said, she accomplished everything. Her cup was full. Was the right time. And it's really miraculous because very few athletes get to do it in that way.
Yeah, she finished on such a high, and I hear she's writing children's books now. That's really cool. Now, my next question, and actually the last question I have prepped for you, is about the future. We have obviously French Open first, then Wimbledon. And I don't know if you feel comfortable answering this question, so if you don't, totally fine. It's about Medvedev. And of course, now injuries aren't the only thing that may prevent him from playing this summer. But he was told by Wimbledon that if he wants to compete, he would have to denounce the Russian president, Putin. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Oh, that's getting deep. I think it's very difficult for both the Russians and the Ukrainians, because, to denounce Putin, now if you ever go back to Russia or if your family's there, it's a very difficult situation to be in. It's so unfortunate that Ukrainian tennis players and the Russian tennis players have to be in this situation. I think let's watch that all unfold and see how it goes. You know, Svitolina has pulled off the tour now, understandably. She's just too emotional. She's Ukrainian with what's happening with friends, with your country being destroyed. So it's a very difficult situation, and hopefully it starts to change soon.
Yeah, I mean, my perspective is that it's very unfair that they put Medvedev or Daniil in that situation to make that decision. I mean, he's on the rise of his career, and of course now he's hurt, but I mean, if he wasn't hurt, while I'm sure, you know, he doesn't approve of the situation, it's just to make him, you know, he can't go back if he does stuff like if he says he doesn't approve of it, if he puts his country down. But so I think it's like a very uncomfortable situation for him. And I don't know what he would do. It'll be interesting to see how it plays out. Yes. For sure. We actually had Svitolina on here a couple of weeks ago, and she was amazing talking about her country and all that. So thank you for bringing that up.
She's done a great job of trying to raise money, and she's kind of spearheaded a lot for her country. So I'm very proud of her.
Yeah. Are there any last thoughts you wanted to share
women's tennis? I think it's an exciting time for Iga Swiatek. When Ash Barty took her name off the computer, didn't just let it by not playing, just let her name dwindle down the rankings. Iga Swiatek has played so well, winning in the Middle East, winning Indian Wells, winning in Miami, and so many of those matches by a decisive score line. So she's really the dominant player, this year, once Ash Barty, because Ash obviously won the Australian Open. it's been interesting to see all of that unfold. I think it's wide open in women's tennis. I'd like to start to see some rivalries be created so that we can start to see one of those on this paper, and rivalries, we need them to play multiple times. We need to play them, see them play in majors, whether it's semifinals or finals. And right now in women's tennis, it seems like there could be a young one like a Coco Gauff or a Leila Fernandez come through, or an Emma Raducanu. There's still Simona Halep that's very eager and trying to win another major, Muguruza also. So it's wide open. And I think on the men's side, we're feeling that now too, with Roger being 40, although we've seen him coming back in rehab in the last couple of days, which is good news. Some point that rivalry between Nadal and Djokovic and Roger will start to dwindle, and we'll see some lanes open up for, is it the Medvedevs and the Zverevs and the Alcaraz. I love Alcaraz.
Oh my gosh. He has such a bright future. I think he's going to be world number one. I know this is a common take. A lot of people have been saying this, but I really do.
I really think that he'll win a major in the next year or two, because he's so physically, the guy's 18 years old and he's already physically a bull. So I think it's exciting time for, it's a different time for men and women, because it's more wide open. We knew who was going to win most of the majors were Rafa, Roger, and Novak. Now it's more open. And I think that's kind of fun. It's different.
Yeah, that's a great take. Like on the women's side, there was always like different winners and more diversity kind of, but in the men's, it was always, you know, the top four greats. So no, I think that's interesting for our sport, and I'm excited to see like what comes out of it.
Some new names.
New names, new rivalries. And yeah, I mean, this is an exciting time.
It is. It really is. And you know, one last thing is I want to remind folks that are interested in tennis to go vote at tennisfame.com/vote. And not only is it fun, and I think it'll be enjoyable, you'll be able to reminisce about some of these great epic storylines that maybe you remember, and if you don't, you'll learn something from. It might inspire some young players, but you'll come away knowing more history than you knew about before, and you'll get some banter and some nice back and forth. But most importantly also is if you do vote, then you have the opportunity to win a trip to the Newport Hall of Fame this summer, when Leighton Hewitt is going to be inducted the weekend of July 15th through 17th. They call it the Enshrinement Weekend. So it's something to be part of. And one person in the United States is going to win two tickets to go, and all expenses paid there.
Very cool. Sounds like a great time. Great opportunity. Thank you for sharing that.
Oh, that sounds pretty easy.
Yeah, definitely. Well, that sounds good. Thank you so much, Tracy. I really appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Great to see you, Julia.
Well, that was this week's episode. I really appreciate everyone taking the time to listen in and tune in to such a legend, Tracy Austin. If you enjoyed this week's episode, please like, review, subscribe, follow me on social media at Jules El Baba, at JulesElBaba. And if you'd like to make a donation to my marathon, much appreciated. We're still looking to raise $1,000 more for the Colon Cancer Foundation. Links can be found on my Instagram and Twitter, or you can just DM me and I will give it to you. Anyways, guys, thank you so much for tuning in, and I will see you guys next time on Jules on the Hustle.
Every day I'm hustling, 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 every day I'm hustling.